Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rose. Welcome to Rewiring Your Brain. And we're wired by every person that we meet. And with most people that we love, it's more positive than negative. But unfortunately, there's a buildup of negativity, and this ends up in what we call learned helplessness. My guests are change agents, and each has managed to do major brain rewiring and now are empowering others. Now, each can rewire your brain to improve your life. Today's guest is Ken Anderson with his book, How to Change Your Drinking. It is a harm reduction program, and I just told him, you know, that I felt that it was more than just something about drinking, that this basic premise of an attitude in the whole program will help anybody that's going to be a caregiver as well as someone who is trying to change their behavior. So I know Ken's going to be rewiring your brain. Again, welcome, Ken.
Thank you, Dr. Rose, for having me on your show today.
Okay, what we want to do usually in the beginning is get some idea of who you are as a person. And like I said in the introduction, you know, you've been wired by certain people. And who are some of the people that either gave you positive rewiring or those that helped you develop learned helplessness that led to your own drinking?
Well, my own drinking was caused by some negative circumstances in my life. I had been through some negative experiences and was suffering quite a bit of depression and started taking, to drinking too much alcohol to combat that. And I realized that this was becoming a big problem and was not reasonable to, get completely drunk four nights a week and go to work hungover and other things like that. And I started taking some steps to try and change my drinking. I was involved with a group called Moderation Management for a while, and I got a number of good ideas from them. They were helpful, but I was looking for more. I heard about the idea of harm reduction while I was there, and I wanted to pursue this more in depth. And I found out most of the harm reduction programs around at that point were aimed at drug users. Needle exchange was one example. And I decided while I was living in Minneapolis to volunteer at the Minneapolis Needle Exchange and learn more about harm reduction. And the more I learned, the more I realized that this was something that really needed to be applied to alcohol. So eventually I decided to start this free of charge, lay-led support group for people who drink alcohol that's based on the principles of harm reduction. Now, I want to explain a little bit about what harm reduction is, because some people seem to have some mistaken ideas about it. I was just listening to a radio show this morning on the internet by someone, you know, from the more traditional background who was just condemning harm reduction. And I said, well, yeah, but you don't understand it at all. Harm reduction supports every positive change, and harm reduction supports anything that reduces harm, which means that, you know, If you abstain from a high-risk behavior, that is harm reduction because you have reduced the harm from that behavior. If any high-risk behavior, I'm going to take driving an automobile as an example because this is an example where people do use harm reduction a lot, and it's totally accepted, although they don't always use the term harm reduction. One way to avoid all the risks of driving an automobile is to not drive, is to stop driving completely. And abstaining from driving, of course, reduces your risk of, you know, getting in an automobile accident, you know, 100%. You know.
Right.
Whereas it's not practical for everyone to not drive. It can be very impractical, and, you know, if you try to start a campaign to stop everyone from driving, I don't think you'd get very far. So instead of doing that, we have a harm reduction device. It's called a seatbelt. And the seatbelt helps to reduce the injuries from the accidents that we know are going to happen. You know, sometimes, you know, as long as people do drive automobiles, there will be some automobile accidents that can't be prevented 100%, but we can reduce, you know, the harms that result from these accidents. So that's one example of a harm reduction device. So when it comes to drugs or alcohol, of course, total abstinence, reduces all the risks to zero. So it is the safest course. And harm reductionists are totally in favor of anyone that can abstain successfully. What happens very often is, programs attempt to force abstinence upon people against their will. And what happens when you try to force someone to change in a way that they don't want to is you get rebellion and, you actually increase the behaviors. So, tell people, no, you're really bad. Don't drink because you're a really bad person because you drink. And they say, they say, oh, go away. I'm going to drink all I want because I'm not going to do what you tell me to do.
Yeah, I think you mentioned before the show started about the book about mugging. And I think that, people that are trying to lose weight especially, everybody nags at them, everybody picks on them, and the media picks on them. And so their responses usually get fatter or get just a negative reaction. So tell us a little about how to get that other book and what that's about.
Oh, yes. I want to recommend this book very highly. It's by Robert Myers and Brenda Wolf. It's called Get Your Loved One Sober, Alternatives to Nagging and Pleading. And it's available everywhere. Robert Myers has been working at the University of New Mexico for many years now, developing what he calls the CRAFT approach. CRAFT is it's an acronym that means Community Reinforcement and Family Training. And this teaches a form of motivational interviewing. I mean, when you talk to people, if you can approach them at a rational level and a calm level, and you say, for example, it's your loved one has a drinking problem, and you say to them, well, what are some of the good things about drinking? And you start at that point and then say, well, are there any bad things about drinking that you don't like? Well, people are pretty quick. If they've had bad consequences with drinking, they know them, and they can come up with them. If you give them a chance to say, well, I got a DUI, it's going to cost me a fortune, it's really causing me lots of problems. If people, volunteer that information themselves, it's very different than if you point your finger at them and say, you got a DUI, you're a bad person, you have to stop drinking. When they bring it up from themselves, they start motivating themselves to make changes, and they will start making positive changes. Whether to be safer with their drinking or to reduce or to quit completely. Because many people do find quitting completely is actually easier than trying to reduce. So many people find that to be their best solution. But it works best when people find the solution for themselves instead of having it imposed upon them from the outside.
Okay, because I know that's the same thing that I found to be true with teaching kids. When you're constantly trying to force them to do things, it's not as effective as when you respect them and help them understand. One of the first things in your 17 elements is help them do a cost-benefit analysis. So tell us about the cost-benefit analysis idea.
Well, there's been a lot of research on the cost-benefit analysis that's found that it's very helpful, and lots of people recommend it. My colleague Pat Denning, who wrote the book Over the Influence, also recommends this. Hers is the Harm Reduction Guide for Drug Users. Ours is a Harm Reduction Guide for People Who Drink Alcohol. And, I got the idea from her, but it's been tested by many people. And the cost-benefit analysis, it's also called a decisional balance sheet by some people. It involves getting out four sheets of paper and writing down the pros of your current behavior. Say you're drinking alcohol. What are the good things about your current drinking habits? And then the next sheet you write down, what are the bad things about your current drinking habits? And then on the third sheet, you write about your proposed goal. Say that you want to reduce your drinking. Write down the good things about reducing your drinking. And on the fourth sheet, write down the bad things about reducing your drinking. And it's very important that people become conscious that, there are some pros to their current drinking habits. They wouldn't engage in this behavior if there weren't some benefits. And it's important to become conscious of, what are the benefits of the way you're drinking. Now, first, if you try to repress them and just make a list of all the bad things, well, the good things stay in your subconscious and they come back at you. And, this is what causes people to relapse. and, you know, to fail in their behavior change, in attempting to repress the good things. So it's important to be consciously aware that there are benefits. And second, once you are aware that there are benefits, you can start thinking about ways to achieve these benefits without using alcohol. For example, if people drink to relax, there are other ways to relax besides using alcohol. People can do yoga, they can meditate, they can exercise. So, you know, if you're aware that you use alcohol for relaxation, you can go and find other ways for relaxation that don't involve alcohol. Likewise, if you use it to overcome social phobia, to help you talk to people, well, you can maybe join Toastmasters and practice talking in front of crowds until you're more comfortable talking in front of people.
Okay. So, actually, that goes to the next one, which is you're choosing your drinking goal. Once you put your cost-benefit analysis down on paper, you're actually beginning to choose your drinking goal, whether it's, and tell about the three major drinking goals or non-drinking goals.
Well, your goals in relation to alcohol, you could choose to quit entirely, which many people do, or you could choose to be safer, or you could choose to reduce your drinking. And regardless of what goal you choose, we always recommend people to think about being safer, always think about being safe. Even if your goal is quitting, you know, because you might not be perfect and you might slip up sometime. And if you do drink again, you know, we want you to be safe. So, you know, it's always important to be safe. And you can have goals of being a safer and reduced drinker at the same time. So they're not mutually exclusive that way. But these are things that people can choose to work on, be safer, drink less, or quit entirely.
Well, what do you find with people? Are there certain character types that choose? If you meet somebody, you know, the first time, what would you look for to see and kind of predict which one of them they're going to take? Is there anything character-wise or environmental or whatever that would help you understand that so we can understand it better?
It's actually very difficult to predict what a person is going to choose. But there's been a lot of research, including Martha Sanchez Craig at the Addiction Research Foundation in Toronto, and also Mark and Linda Sobel have done a lot of research into goal choice. And when people are allowed to choose whether they want to be moderate or whether they want to cut back or whether they want to quit drinking entirely, they do much better than if you impose a goal of abstinence on everyone from the outset. So this has been studied in experimental settings. And what they found is, you know, quite a few people do choose the goal of moderate drinking initially. And a smaller number choose abstinence initially. But a number of people that try to follow the moderate drinking goal will switch to abstinence. And they will be more successful at quitting after they've had the chance, you know, to attempt moderation on their own because it's not being forced upon them once again. So it really seems the best thing to do is to allow everyone to make their own goal choice. And, you know, many people that do choose abstinence, they're not even what we might consider heavy drinkers. Maybe they have 2 glasses of wine every night. And suddenly they say, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't like the idea of drinking at night anymore. I want to quit completely. And, you know, we say it doesn't matter how much you drink or how little you drink. You know, we will support you in making any positive change that you want to make.
How much influence do, you know, like a parent or a spouse or a friend have on making these choices for most people?
Well, as I've said, if the spouse chooses to nag and plead and do the traditional type of thing, they probably are going to have their efforts backfire and, you know, result in the person drinking more. If they take the other approach, you know, the craft approach that I mentioned before, which is also kind of a motivational interviewing approach applied at the lay level, and, you know, just talk to the person. What are the good things about drinking? What are the bad things? well, do you want to get rid of some of these bad things? And, you know, do it on a more conversational level. This is much more successful.
What I've seen is that a person's been drinking for a while, they're very sensitive about any kind of criticism because they have been nagged and pled with, as you say. So I think initially, if they're even in with the harm reduction program, they're going to be suspicious. So how do you handle that?
Well, you have to be very careful because, you know, not only are they sensitive because they've been nagged at, but they're very aware, you know, under the surface that the problems are really there. So it's important to take a gentle approach. It's a motivational interviewing type of approach. I mentioned that word before. Motivational interviewing is something that's invented by Bill Miller and Stephen Rolnick, also at the University of New Mexico. And it's a very effective way at helping people to change. It helps to motivate them to change their habits. And it's done not by nagging or not by yelling at people and shaking your finger in their face and telling them how terrible they are, or not by attempting to increase, you know, negative consequences about drinking. All these things wind up backfiring. What you do is, you know, you talk to the people in a calm manner, and, you know, what are the positives? What are the negatives? And, you know, ask, do you want to make some change, you know, and don't try to impose the change upon them by force. Miller and Rolnick have a book out about motivational interviewing, which, although it was written for professionals, I think it can also be useful, you know, even for regular lay people, you know, who have a loved one that does drink and have problems with alcohol or drugs. And I think it's a helpful book for them to read.
Okay. One of the things that I think that you do so well in the book is let's talk about safer drinking. I know that that's down further in your elements, but I think safer drinking, when you explain to people how they can drink, I know that I just read this morning, you know, the difference between diluting the drink with a diet drink as opposed to a regular drink, like diet 7-Up as opposed to 7-Up, and how it affects them physiologically different. I think this really is dramatic because the spouse or parent, if they understood those things better, they might be able to help the person direct toward alleviating some of the problems because I think it's easier for someone to change from diet drink to a regular soda and then, you know, quitting drinking. So at least we're starting safer drinking that way. So would you explain something about that, how that physiologically affects them?
Yeah, there are many, many factors that will change how rapidly your blood alcohol content rises when you drink. One is that diet drinks will tend to get your blood alcohol higher. If you mix diet drinks with alcohol, they'll get your blood alcohol content higher than just a regular soda. So if this is being a problem, if people are having blackouts when they drink or other problems with becoming intoxicated really quickly, there are ways to slow down the rise in blood alcohol content to make the drinking safer and to avoid blackouts and other problems. So one is to use regular soda in your mixed drink instead of a diet soda, because diet sodas have been demonstrated by research to raise the blood alcohol content higher. There are other things that people can do. Eating a good meal before you drink any alcohol is very helpful because the small intestine is made to absorb liquids. So you close a valve between the stomach and the small intestine when you eat food, and it keeps the alcohol in the stomach, so it only goes into the bloodstream very slowly, and you don't get these spikes in the blood alcohol content, and you don't get the blackouts and as many negative consequences. Another thing that people do is alternate a glass of water with a glass of wine, or a non-alcoholic beer with a real beer, or do something to slow down the rate that they're drinking, because slowing it down helps a lot to avoid problems.
Well, one of the things that I can see a problem starting with that is that, once they learn some of those techniques, they're going to slow down the absorption, everything, and they're going to get, but they're not going to get the high that they're used to as quickly. So wouldn't they increase the number of drinks because they're looking for that high?
Well, one of the things that happens very often when people have the blood alcohol content rise quickly is that they go into a blackout. And, of course, people aren't seeking blackouts when they drink. That's not something that people want because they can't control their behavior. They have no memory of it. And, no one enjoys a blackout. So definitely people that are having the blackouts are going to want to institute these strategies to prevent them so that they can actually enjoy the effect of the alcohol because they'll actually, be conscious and aware of it.
No, but what I'm saying, Ken, is that, that someone has been drinking steadily for years. They kind of know how much it takes to get that the high that they get because they want that pleasure sense. And when you start cutting down and you start eating more, and doing all the good things you're saying to prevent the absorption and to help your liver and everything, wouldn't some of them or maybe most of them want to drink more quicker because they want to get high?
Well, we don't condemn anyone for getting the high or reaching the high that they want to achieve. As I said, these are strategies for preventing the blackout. But if you're not having the blackout, if you are enjoying your high from your alcohol, we don't condemn that morally. But what we do suggest is that you take steps. If you're having problems with your behaviors when you do achieve the high, I mean, if you want to go out and drive, you need to ensure that, your car keys are not available. Maybe you want to give them to your spouse before you have any alcohol at all, or do something to lock them up. Make sure that you're not able to drive before, you start drinking at all. We suggest many strategies for people to be safer. If you have a problem with calling up your boss and chewing him out when you get full of alcohol, maybe you need to lock up your telephone before you start drinking. We also suggest, if people are going to go out drinking, that always use public transportation to get to the bar so your car's not there so you don't have it to drive home. In New York, we have subways, and that's great, and there's taxi cabs everywhere, and there's no reason why anyone in New York City should ever have to drink and drive. But even if you're at a place where the public transportation is not so great, that you can always figure out ways with a designated driver or something that you never have to drink and drive. There's no reason why you should have to do that. So we always encourage people to find strategies to be safer and to reduce the risk and, if possible, to eliminate the high-risk behaviors that accompany the drinking of alcohol.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'm asking you is, person A, uses these safe strategies, safer drinking, but because they're not getting the high as quickly, so they drink more. And is the accumulation now of more in an evening, say, or whatever the time it takes them to drink, is it a bigger buildup, or is it more dangerous or harmful to the body?
Well, I'm going to address that in a slightly different way than you asked it. First, all the elements of the HEMS program are optional, and we encourage people to take only the ones that they find useful and helpful to them. So if a person does want to drink on an empty stomach, we don't condemn that, if that's what gets them the high that they want to get, we don't condemn that. If they want to, if they've been having blackouts and want to avoid blackouts, we say, okay, one way to avoid that is by eating first. But we don't tell them, if you like the high that you get when you drink an empty stomach, we don't tell them, you have to change that. We don't tell people that they have to change any behavior.
Okay. Let's go to risk-taking and risk evaluation.
Yes, we have worksheets in the book. They're also available on the website that you can download and print out for free to rank your high-risk behaviors. We mentioned some before, drinking and dialing, drinking and driving, unsafe sex when you're intoxicated, if you meet strangers in the bar and have unsafe sex. We encourage people to write down a list of the high-risk behaviors that they've engaged in while drinking and then rank them, because some are worse than others. You know, if you get intoxicated and you call up your friend on the phone while you're kind of loaded, it might be a little obnoxious, but it's not, it's not as high risk as calling up your boss when you're intoxicated. And it's not as high risk as drinking and driving. So we encourage people, to rank the risk and to try to eliminate the most problematic behaviors. You know, spend the most energy on eliminating the biggest problems first. So it's kind of prioritize your goals. And then we have people write down the strategies that will work for them to help them to eliminate these high-risk behaviors.
What do you find when they do this high-risk evaluation? How effective did you find that?
People tend to find it very effective. Some are easier to get rid of than others. But just to cite some studies that have been done with harm reduction for drug users, needle exchange. Sharing needles is the biggest high-risk behavior, probably, with people who inject drugs. And if they can always use clean needles, they greatly eliminate the risk of, transmission of HIV, Hep C. Using a clean, new, fresh needle every time greatly reduces the chances of getting abscesses and other big problems that accompany injecting drugs. So we found that when clean needles are made available to people, and in a non-judgmental manner, and, when people come into the needle exchange and you say, thank you for bringing in these used needles and getting them off the street, here are some clean ones, please use these, please always use these, we really appreciate that you're doing a good thing. And, you treat them respectfully, and people are very happy to use clean needles, and the effect on HIV rates is very dramatic. They drop a great deal when you introduce a needle exchange into a community. So, if you give people a chance to be safer, it's very effective in reducing the risks.
Okay, the next thing is, it says learn about the HAMS tools and strategies for changing your drinking. You've actually been talking about a lot of them, but maybe a little bit more specific on a couple.
Yes, we have a very big toolbox here of many, many different things that people can do. And this whole chapter of the book is also on the website, available for free to anyone that wants to look at it. And there are so many different things that people can choose from to change their drinking habits. And it's because there's so many different people out there, and different people find different things to be effective. One of the ones that we found is medical marijuana. For some people, stopping alcohol completely and replacing it with medical marijuana can be a much safer way for them to get a high. And, people who have, for example, liver damage and they can't drink anymore, cannabis is not harmful to the liver, so that's a good substitute for those people. People who get into fights in bars, when they drink alcohol, if they smoke cannabis, cannabis does not make people belligerent and doesn't provoke fights. So that's a very good substitute for many people. And also people who have a withdrawal syndrome and have seizures or DTs, these can actually kill you. Severe withdrawal from alcohol can be very dangerous. And people who have problems with severe alcohol withdrawal, if they substitute cannabis does not have this type of withdrawal, so they are much safer. So this is just one tool, and it's been studied quite a bit by a couple of people in California. Dr. Amanda Ryman is studying it currently. The late Dr. Todd McCuria also studied this quite a bit and found that, for many people, this was a much better substitute than using alcohol or other drugs.
Are the DEA people after you or anything?
Well, I just I was kind of careful to say use medical marijuana with a prescription. But in reality, some people do, in states that don't have medical marijuana, also use it as a substitute, and they do have better results. So it's the reality.
Okay, number five here says make a plan to achieve your drinking goal. And I think that's true for anything, like I would keep talking about caregivers. You know, the caregiver should make some realistic plans, and I'm saying realistic plans, about how to deal with the person they're helping. And one of them is what you've talked about before about not nagging and things like that. So making a plan is from the standpoint of the person with the problem. But should they make it, or is it a good idea to make it, or is that too intrusive?
Well, as I said, all of the HAMS elements are optional. People can do the ones that they want to that appeal to them. They can also be done in any order. They're just kind of set up in a default order. If you don't know where to start, the cost-benefit analysis is a good place to start. But you don't have to start there. You can start with a plan. You can start with charting. You can start with being safer. You can start with any place that appeals to you is good. Now, making a plan, it's not required, but many people find it helpful. And we suggest that writing the plan down is better than doing it in your head. So writing it down is a good way to go. And there are different ways, We have an email support group online, and a lot of people post their plans to the group so that it can give them some accountability. And no one will ever condemn you for not sticking to your plan, because in our opinion, every positive change that you make is good. If you plan to abstain 6 days out of the week and drink one, and your actual accomplishment was only to abstain one day, we're going to say, well, it was really good that you did the one day, because doing one day is better than doing no days. So we would never condemn people. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, too, because what I do with student teachers is I try to get across to them that the plans that they make are guides. It's not something written in cement. And so when you... When they deviate from the plan or it doesn't work out the way they want, you just reorder the plan or you rethink the plan instead of, bashing yourself and say, oh, my God, I failed. I had this plan and that didn't work. And, and you learn from your mistakes. So the plan is just a guide, a help.
Absolutely. We find that when people start condemning themselves, then they start feeling bad. And then the first thing they do when they feel bad is they want to drink. So condemning yourself doesn't help. So always, being positive of any positive change that you made is a good thing. And you can say, well, I didn't make my plan this time, but I'm going to revise it next time. Maybe I'm not going to be so strict next time. Or maybe I'm just going to try again because I know I can do it next time and keep trying until it works. But, being condemning oneself and, living in the past and beating oneself up for not being perfect is never, never helpful. Are we talking about making a plan? We suggest a written plan. Some people might write a very simple plan, like I'm going to drink on Saturday night and not any other day of the week. Other people might want to get down a calendar and say, okay, on Tuesday I'm going to have 3 drinks. On Wednesday I'm going to have 0. On Saturday I'm going to have 10 because I'm going to cut loose. And that's good too.
Okay, the another one here you have is use alcohol-free time to reset your drinking habits. Isn't it hard for a person that is a heavy drinker to find alcohol-free time? Or how do they handle?
Yes, it can be difficult. So if people have been drinking every day for a long time, we tell them, try to do just one day of abstinence. Because, if you can accomplish even one day, then that you can do a day. And then next time you can say, okay, I'm going to do 2 days next time. Some people will start with abstaining one day a week for the first month, and then the second month they will try to abstain 2 days a week, and the third month 3 days a week. And there are ways to add it in gradually. some other people say, well, I really need a break, so I'm going to take a month off with no drinking, or I'm going to take 2 months off with no drinking, or I'm going to take a week off with no drinking. We don't have an absolute set number that, you know, we suggest. We say, you know, choose your own, but, you know, a lot of people just say, well, a month off is a good amount. So they will try and take a month off, and many of them will succeed, and it gives people a chance to encounter, you know, all the drinking situations without drinking, and it really helps them to reset their habits a lot. The one thing we do say, again, if people are going, or people are having withdrawal syndrome, if they start having bad shakes and sweats and the pulse is high and the blood pressure is high, you know, we say, well, don't quit cold turkey. If you think you're going to have severe withdrawal, you will either need to taper off the alcohol, or you will need to get a prescription from your doctor for some withdrawal medications, or you will need to check into a medical detox facility. So we do warn people, you know, if you're having bad withdrawal, you know, don't just keep quitting cold turkey, because it can be very dangerous for your health. But if you're not having that withdrawal, the alcohol-free time is very useful for people in resetting their habits.
Okay. And during that time, then they can practice what you say, learn to cope without booze?
Absolutely.
So you have, I know there's chapters in there that, you know, make suggestions for people to do in the place of their drinking.
Well, many people who are heavy drinkers have problems with things like depression or anxiety or social phobia. Not everyone has these outside issues, but many people do have these things, and, you know, they need to learn some new coping skills. We talk about cognitive behavioral therapy, which you can get, you know, from self-help books. We give a few examples of how to do it yourself in our book, and, you know, there are ways to change your thinking. So when you start thinking depressed thoughts and you realize you're getting into that loop, you tell yourself to stop, and you try to change your thoughts into something that's not depressing thoughts. And if people start practicing this exercise of monitoring their thoughts and stopping the negative thoughts, they very often find that they can change their thoughts and not have depression as often as they used to, or not have anxiety as often as they used to. It can be a very helpful exercise to help change depression or anxiety, social phobia, things like that.
Well, do you suggest them, you know, people take some antidepressant? You know, I know that you said that it's not a good idea to drink with antidepressants. So what do you suggest to people that have depression, and that might be one of the reasons that they're drinking? How do they handle that when they're, you know, making a choice about safer drinking?
Well, I think people should be very cautious about taking psychiatric medications and antidepressants. There's more research recently that shows they probably have more side effects than we used to think, and more negative effects. So although some people do find antidepressants to be lifesavers, and, you know, I would never say, you know, any absolute statement about not taking them, I do suggest that people be cautious before they start a prescription for antidepressants. If people are already taking them, it's not good to stop them suddenly. So, you know, be very careful about if you choose to get off your antidepressant medication. That's something you need to be very careful about and work with a doctor on getting off of them with a gradual taper schedule, perhaps. Some people do find them very helpful, but I think they've been way over-prescribed, and they've been handed out like candy, and I think they've actually done a lot of damage.
Okay. You know, because they're working on, you know, they're helping getting over their depression, you know, either use antidepressant medication or therapy. Your group's therapy often doesn't work either. What you're talking about, the HAMS groups seem to be something that would help people. Tell us a little bit about these HAMS groups, or the hamsters, as you guys call yourself.
Absolutely. We have a live chat group that's at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and 6 p.m. Pacific. We have people from all over the world that drop into the chat to talk. We also have an email group with people from all over the world that send in emails and share with each other. And people do find that, you know, participating in a group is very often helpful for them, not only to be accountable about their drinking habits, to get ideas for change, but also the social aspect is very good, you know, to help people deal with things like depression, anxiety, social phobia. Being involved, particularly online, is very easy. So if you're a very shy person, it's much easier to be brave and type out an email than to actually interact, you know, face-to-face. I used to have a great deal of social phobia, and definitely participating in online groups helped me to overcome it. I'm now much better at dealing face-to-face with people. I have overcome a great deal of my social phobia and social anxieties and shyness that I used to have. The HAMS groups are very good to participate in. There are also other things that people can participate in. Getting out and being with people is really good. If you have religious beliefs, you can get involved with a church group or a synagogue. If you're an atheist, there are atheist groups out there. One thing that I did, as I mentioned, was volunteer in needle exchange. The original idea was to learn about harm reduction, but it was actually a very positive experience for me to be out working and doing something to help people. And also the other people that worked at the exchange were such kind and sweet people. They were a great bunch of people to be around.
Okay. Now, I understand the online groups and everything like that. Do you actually have a, local groups where people actually meet together face-to-face?
Yes, we have one live group in Brooklyn, New York. So far, there's just the one live group. And last time, there were five people there. So we're doing okay on the live group, but it's much more difficult to establish these. These are going to take more time to establish. It's much easier to get the online groups going because people, you know, it's very convenient. You just send an email.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, next thing. It really ties in what you just said. How do you address the things that, the outside issues that really provoke the drinking?
Yes, these can be very important for some people to address their outside issues. There are, as I mentioned, there are some self-help books that you can use and self-help techniques. If these are not sufficient, you can also see a professional therapist and have a professional therapist work with you to help you get through your issues of depression, anxiety, social phobia, whatever issues you may be having that are making you drink and making it difficult to change your drinking habits. And absolutely, people are free to talk about their outside issues in our groups. I don't know if you've ever been to an AA meeting, but if you go to AA and you start talking about depression, all of a sudden you get shut off, and that's an outside issue. You can't talk about that here. Well, we don't say that at all in our group. We say you can talk about any issue that's affecting your drinking at all, or really any issue that you feel any need to talk about. You're welcome to talk about it, whether it's outside issue or not an outside issue. We did mention psychiatric meds. Some people can find them to be a real lifesaver. So I do recommend people to be cautious and not to just take Prozac, you know, the minute they stub their toe. But for some people, they can be very helpful.
Okay, well, I suggest people, too, if they're looking for a book, my own, Creating Your Giant Self, with the new title, The Best Self-Help Book Ever, forward by Robert Anton Wilson, who wrote that, said that. And what I try to do is get people to face what I talk about, rewiring your brain. I wrote that almost 25 years ago, but it was getting people to face the reality of life in a way that doesn't sugarcoat it, but doesn't make it to be a burden, but just make people be aware of things that they do. For example, how you generalize. When people talk about prejudice is an overgeneralization from very little information. But this is the way the brain operates. So what I try to do in the book is to get people to understand how their brain operates and the different institutions and how they affect them. And I obviously think it's a very helpful book. Anyway, and part of that is the next one that you have down here, Learn to Believe in Yourself. Because I think when you understand all these kinds of things, you'll have a better belief in yourself. And I very strongly want people to understand that. So how do you address that? Learn to believe in yourself.
It's very important to help people to believe in themselves. Albert Bandura has done research on self-efficacy. And what he has found, people that believe that they can change their habits are successful at changing their habits. People that believe that they are powerless over alcohol have a terrible time, you know, to change. My experience is people that have said they're powerless over alcohol with the first step of AA, they wind up going to AA for the rest of their life because they are, you know, relying on AA to fix their drinking for them. And, you know, they can't stop going to the meetings because they'll drink again because they believe that they are powerless and can't do anything themselves. What Bandura's research showed us that, you know, people that believe in themselves are successful at changing their habits. And the best way to help people change their habits is to increase their belief in themselves. And one way to help people increase their belief in themselves is to help them to have small victories. As I talked about earlier, some people have not had a day of abstinence from alcohol for a long time. If they have one day, then suddenly they've made an accomplishment. And we say, that's great. You see, you proved to yourself you can do it. You can stop for one day. And if you can stop for one day, you can stop for 2 days. If you can stop for 2 days, you can stop for three. So, you know, by starting with very small steps, we help people to build up their belief in themselves. You know, you don't tell people to run before they can walk. You know, you don't expect them to write a sonnet while they're still learning the ABCs.
Yeah, well, I definitely found that out as a teacher. I did individualized reading in regular so-called normal classrooms, and instead of just having all group or all class, I spent time almost every day reading with each individual student. And of course, you had to have good control of the class, but I taught them how to control themselves, not me controlling them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's giving people more power over their life. But and this individualization just fits what you're saying, because every day I'd read with the child. And you know, and I had them reading things at their level to read, and as they gained confidence, and they went from, like say there was 34 levels in something, if they went from level 5 to 6, I would announce to the class, well, Ken just went from 5 to 6, and the call class would clap, because they were happy for the person as well as for themselves, because they knew that the same thing is happening with them when they get that those strokes for doing something. Not very huge, just a small step. But these small steps accumulated pretty rapidly, and I would get kids, you know, going a couple of grade levels in one year because of these increments. And I think that's what you're saying here, that that when the person with a problem begins to see that they have more control, even a little bit at a time, that helps their confidence, and that's what changes their behavior.
Absolutely. I read through your website, and I thought that those aspects were just very compatible with the way we view things, and I thought that was a really good way to approach teaching children.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I used to do, that I did in one school, was almost an all-black school, And they had just terrible feelings about themselves, the whole school. And the principal had me take over the after-school playground, and they never won anything. And the first thing I did when I took over the basketball team is I put on all the basketball teams, all the basketballs, 1965 champions, you know. And they said, what are you doing? And I said, because you're going to be champions. Well, we never win anything. Well, you're going to win now, because I'm your coach, and you just follow what I help help you, and you're going to be winners. And for the next 2 years, we won championships in everything that they had, and the whole school felt better about themselves. Everybody felt that, you know, their identity changed. And, you know, that's why people, you know, go to the sports things like, you know, the Lakers. Every time the Lakers win, you feel better about yourself. So you get an identity like that. But all those things also are increments, and the people begin to feel better about themselves. And you just can't underestimate the power of that.
Absolutely. When people start feeling good about themselves, then suddenly that alcohol doesn't have much power to draw them anymore. You know, they will just drink, you know, in a more reasonable manner, more social manner, and a manner with less problems. Or, as I said, many will just say, well, I don't need alcohol anymore, and they will just quit. But when people are feeling good about themselves, you know, it's much easier to change and to maintain the change.
Okay, because that's one of the other ones here. Praise yourself for every success, and I agree with that. Get back on the horse. My wife and I years ago did Cambridge with, you know, people with weight problems. And it was amazing. We'd get somebody, you know, to take it, and they would start losing weight, and then they'd rebound and get it all back. So one of the things we started doing with them is say, look, if you're doing a good job during the whole week, you know, reward yourself. You know, look forward to having that hot fudge sundae. It's not going to make that much difference, because you have earned that. And this was something that made a big difference with a lot of people. And I think you're getting back on the horse is the idea that, okay, if you have a relapse or however they want to call it, that it isn't the end of the world, that you just go back again. So talk a little about relapses, because I think that's critical.
Yes, this also goes with our number 13, which is to practice damage control. And this is a lot of work by Dr. Alan Marlatt, who recently deceased, but he wrote the preface to our book. He was a very influential person in alcohol research, and he wrote a book called Relapse Prevention. And in some ways, you could actually call it relapse control. But it's about, you know, if you have one drink. So your goal is to quit alcohol completely. And if you slip up and you have one drink, does that mean that one drink means that you have to drink 100? One is too many, 1,000 is never enough. One drink means one drunk. Those are some AA slogans that, you know, are around. And he said, no. No, you don't have to keep drinking just because you had one drink. When you realize, you know, that what you've done, you can stop there. Or even if you have one day of drinking, you don't have to go out and now drink for the next 10 years. And you don't have to beat yourself up for having the slip. This is the big problem he found. He called it the abstinence violation effect. When people would break their abstinence, they would suddenly start feeling very guilty, very miserable about themselves. They would start beating themselves up, saying, I'm worthless, I can't do it. And then they would go off into a big bender and drink for days, weeks, months at a time. And he said, you know, it's normal to have some slip-ups. It's very common. You don't have to beat yourself up for not being perfect. You're just being human because you drank for one day. You don't have to beat yourself up. You can go back and start abstaining again the very next day. You don't have to go on a week-long bender, and you don't have to be miserable. You know, it's just normal in the change process for people to have some slip-ups when they change. And he found that when he taught people to stop beating themselves up and stop being so hard on themselves, that they got back to abstaining much more quickly and had a much better success rate.
Yeah, I know. For years, I used to eat either a pint or a quart of chocolate ice cream every night. And probably I'd be dead now if I'd have continued doing that. But and it was very hard for me to stop it. And then I finally got to the point where now, you know, I just have a little piece of chocolate at, you know, after dinner or lunch or something. But there were times when things, you know, you get kind of overwhelmed with stress, And I reward myself. I go get a chocolate ice cream cone, or I go get a sundae or something like that, because I realize that that this is what I need at this point, or I think I need, but it doesn't mean that after that that I'm going to continue it. It's just a temporary thing, and it does placate me and satisfies me, and then I go back to controlling it.
Well, it's really good to have some small rewards. When I was working on weight loss, I did the same thing. Now I slipped off my program for a while, so I got to get back on that. So I quit cigarettes 3 years ago, and it's been difficult with eating ever since.
Okay. One thing I would like you to talk about a little bit is the physiological. I know I was very concerned about people in the family that drank because of so-called brain damage and liver damage and things like that. Talk a little bit about that the next few minutes.
Okay. It's very important if you drink alcohol to get your vitamins, and especially vitamin B1, the thiamine, because if you have a lack of vitamin B1, it can lead to brain damage. And, I mean, lack of vitamin B1 can be caused from alcohol, because alcohol, you know, is very hard. It takes the vitamin B1 right out of your system. It can also be caused, you know, by a really bad diet. We don't see this in the U.S. very often. But some places in Asia where the people are fed only white rice, they get vitamin B1 deficiency. It causes brain damage. It can also happen with severe morning sickness. But anytime people have a real severe shortage of vitamin B1, it can lead to major brain damage. It's called wet brain. So it's very important, you know, for people who drink alcohol to eat a healthy diet, but also take vitamin supplements, and particularly I recommend a multivitamin and a B1 complex, a B complex supplement, to make sure that you get enough B1. Other than the thiamine deficiency, the B1 deficiency, as far as we know, alcohol in and of itself doesn't cause permanent brain damage. Well, if there's liver failure, if there's liver problems, that can also lead to brain damage. But the alcohol itself does not lead to permanent dysfunction. People that stop drinking after being very heavy drinkers for years, if they don't have the B1 deficiency, they will recover their brain functions. You know, it can take some months, it can take up to a year, but the studies that have been done show that the alcohol in and of itself won't cause permanent brain damage, that you can recover all your cognitive functions, even if you have been a severely heavy drinker, as long as you don't have the wet brain that comes from the B1 deficiency.
Well, what about what they call alcohol dementia? Does that cause, permanent memory loss or partial memory loss?
You see, I was looking for that on PubMed, and it's actually controversial whether there is such a thing as alcoholic dementia at all. All the real cases that have been studied thoroughly, it seems to be the vitamin B1 deficiency and the cognitive dysfunctions that just are caused directly from alcohol itself. They all seem to repair themselves over time after people stop drinking, or if they cut down to very rational, moderate levels.
Well, I know that the people in Alzheimer's, because I did some research on that, and they say that, you know, drinking causes irreversible brain damage. So you don't think that's true?
I was not able to find any PubMed published research that confirmed the idea that there is a direct dementia caused by alcohol itself. It seems like it's all caused either by the liver failure or by the B1 deficiency.
Well, I think with all these big organizations like Alzheimer's, you know, people have some initial prejudice, just like people have against marijuana. And so they tend to pick and choose belief systems. and add them on to what they consider their preventions or their therapeutic method, because I found a lot of things wrong with them. For example, the test to determine whether or not the person has Alzheimer's, I find as a psychologist pathetic, you know, because it just leads to too much errors. And when I talked to the people Alzheimer's about that, they got very mad at me. They said, "Well, Alzheimer's is not diagnosed often enough. You know, there's more people that have it." And you know, you can see that they have a vested interest in having people having it, because then you accumulate more money for research. I can understand their desire, but I think they sometimes give you misinformation, because that's where I got so much about irreversible brain damage, and your book is showing that that's not true.
Yes, there was a very large study of people with a lot of cognitive dysfunction that was due to alcohol that followed them up for several years, and it found that the brain functions returned when they stopped drinking. It's only the people with the B1 deficiency that get the permanent brain damage.
Okay. All right. Tell us how to get all your stuff and how to get on your website and things like that.
Okay. Our website is hamsnetwork.org, and you can get information about the book if you go to hamsnetwork.org/book, or we are on Amazon. If you go to Amazon and type in how to change your drinking, our book will come up, and you can order it from Amazon. There's a paper copy. There's also an ebook. If you get the ebook, as I said, all the worksheets are on the website, so you can just go to the website and print out the worksheets for free to use them. Even if you get the paper book, you might just want to print them out and not mark up your book with your pen. But the worksheets are all online for free, and the book is relatively inexpensive. It's a large, it's 286 pages, it's 8x10 workbook size, and it's only $17.
And I would add it's worth every penny. It is probably one of the best things that I've seen in all, you know, I've got about 400 people I've interviewed, and a lot of them in self-help and things. And this definitely is one of the very best, Ken, so... Now, give us just a brief summary of what you want us to take from what you've been talking about.
I want people to know that harm reduction supports every positive change, and we do support abstinence, too. For the people that abstinence works for, we support abstinence. And that people should always praise themselves for making any positive change and for all their successes. And don't beat yourself up for not being perfect. You just make yourself unhappy and make it difficult to change. So try to be positive about yourself and have a positive attitude, and, you know, praise yourself for any small steps you can make for any positive change, whether with alcohol or in any aspect of your life.
Okay. Ken, thank you very much for being on the program. And whenever you get the desire to come on back, give me a call, and we'll put you back on, because your message isn't just for people with alcohol problems. Your whole program fits almost anything to help people become better. So again, thank you for being on the program, and good. I didn't say good luck to you, because you're making it. So thanks again, Ken.
Thanks for having me.
Bye bye.
Bye.